The first chant is the homage to the Buddha and the refuges and the precepts. Going for refuge and taking the precepts. And aside for their appropriateness around the time of death, the refuges and the precepts are done at any point where a Buddhist might feel a need to recommit or be reminded or plunge into the deepest orientation, the deepest understanding, the deepest protection that they know. So sometimes in times of crisis and difficulty, when people come to a Buddhist temple, one of the first things they do is chant these. So for now, just listen as I do it. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Panatipata Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami. Harinadana Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami. Musavada Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami. Kamesu Michachara Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami. Surameriya Maja Pamadatana Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami. I undertake the training of not killing. I undertake the training of not taking what is not given. I undertake the training of not lying. I undertake the training of not misusing sexuality. I undertake the training to abstain from using mind-altering substances or activities. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hate and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. The next one is adopted from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It was adopted by Vipassana teachers in the 1980s to be used to help people in their dying, to be read while they're dying. Remember the clear light, the pure, clear, white light from which everything in the universe comes, to which everything in the universe returns, the original nature of your own mind, the natural state of the universe unmanifest. Let go into the clear light, trust it, merge with it. It is your own nature, it is home. The visions you experience exist within your consciousness. The forms they take are determined by your past attachments, your past desires, your past fears, your past karma. These visions and thoughts have no reality outside your consciousness. No matter how frightening some of them may seem, they cannot hurt you. Just watch them pass through your consciousness. They will all pass in time. No need to become involved with them. No need to become attracted to the beautiful visions. No need to be repulsed by the frightening ones. No need to be seduced or excited by the sexual ones. No need to be attached to them at all. Just let them pass. If you become involved with these visions, you may have to wander for a long time confused. Just let them pass through your consciousness like the clouds passing through an empty sky. Fundamentally, they have no more reality than this. Remember these teachings. Remember the clear light, the pure, bright, shining white light of your own nature. It is deathless. If you can look into the visions, you can experience and recognize that they are composed of the same pure, clear, white light as everything else in the universe. No matter where or how far you wander, the light is only a split second, a half breath away. It is never too late to recognize the clear light. In another passage that's sometimes read, it comes from the Zen tradition. The way is perfect, like vast space, where there's no lack and no excess. Awakening is to go beyond both emptiness as well as form. All changes in this empty world seem real because of ignorance. The great way is without limit, beyond the easy and the hard. Just let go now of the clinging mind, and all things are just as they are. In essence, nothing goes or stays. To seek great mind with a thinking mind is certainly a grave mistake. If mind does not discriminate, all things are as they are, as one. When all is seen with a mind of equality, we return to our most intimate nature. When the mind is fully with the way, all ego-centered striving cease, doubts and confusion disappear, and so true faith pervades our life. There is no thing that clings to us, and nothing that is left behind. In this true world of emptiness, both self and other are no more. The way is beyond all space, all time. One instant in 10,000 years. One instant is 10,000 years. Not only here, not only elsewhere. Truth is right before your very eyes. One thing is all things are one. Know this, and all is whole and complete. When faith and the mind are not separate, all this very reality is beyond all words, all thought. For here there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, and no today. And the final one I'll read is a dedication of merit, a sharing of blessings, it's sometimes called. And a very important part of Buddhist practice is sharing one's blessings, one's benefits, one's merit. And this is often done for a person as they're dying, to gladden their mind, so they can rejoice and be happy in their blessings. And it's also done after a person has died, both for the person who's died, for their benefit if they can hear it, but also for the benefit of those people, anybody who hears it, so in a memorial service or a funeral. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. And then finally, a very short chant, which is sometimes called the Theravada funeral chant, because it's very intimately connected to funerals, memorial services. But it's actually chanted on many different occasions, great, happy occasions, all occasions. It's a very, very central and important chant. Anicca vata sankara upadavayo dhammino upakituva niruchanti te sangvupassamo sukho. All conditioned things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Those who see deeply, those who realize deeply the calming, the peace of these formations, these conditioned phenomena, will find happiness. Those are resources that are available for people as they're dying and after they're dead. Things that I use when I go visit people who are dying or people who are dead. And there are also resources that can be used, or things that are chanted and said also in times like tonight. And I don't know if all of you had your radio on when you were coming over here today, but I didn't know this until I turned my radio on at 7:15 to come down here in my car, and I heard President Bush basically announce that the war had started. So it just, that's, you know, where we find ourselves. And it seems a little bit odd to be talking about anything else or relating to anything else given what's happened. We will have a gathering tomorrow evening at 7 in order to somehow hold the war and the beginning of the war as a community. And Monday night we talked about this, and very clearly we said we should continue with a class. Some people said we should continue the class if war was declared, and because the class seems important. And the person who was most vocal about the importance of continuing the class is not here tonight. And so who knows what that is about. And so what do you all feel like doing? You want me to just continue, venture forth and finish the class? Or would you like to do something different since venture forth? And somehow it does seem appropriate enough, talking about death. How do we respond to death? How are we with death? So as we did last week, if you don't mind, I'd very much appreciate it if you'd all, especially in the chairs, most all of you, for a little bit, you'd come closer. So, for my sake, I feel more connected to you all. Also, the center here will be open all day tomorrow, starting at, I think, 7 a.m. And just be here, open. Someone will always be here during the day. And it'll be open if you just want to come and sit. There's a lot of centers of faith centers, churches and synagogues and mosques and stuff, they're open their doors now with the fact that the war has started, to mark the beginning, to bring people together. So if that's something you'd like to do tomorrow, you know that the place is open, and come and sit and meditate. And in the evening we'll have our gathering as a community, bigger gathering. Now in terms of the class, One thing that, building on what we talked about a little bit last week and the week before, in terms of preparing for one's death, maybe perhaps well before your you know, death seems to be in sight, there are all kinds of resources, a lot of resources out there, a lot of books on the whole topic of death and dying, and a lot of places you can get support. And it's very easy to find now, these kinds of things, much more than it was 25 years ago. But there's this book called the Beneficiary Book, which is was put together as a way of helping people prepare for all the kind of legal, financial, medical things you want to have well thought out ahead of time. And the book's very interesting because it's mostly, as I understand from the description, it's a whole bunch of questions that you want to answer. So rather than telling you and giving you, you know, what's what, just ask all these questions that you have to kind of, I guess, find out for yourself. And some of them, I imagine, are pretty practical and straightforward, you know, what's your bank account number? And others are, you know, probably much more, you know, soul searching, you know, deep questions about what would you like at that point, that, you know, as you're dying or after you're dead. So there's this order form for it here. And so if you want to look at this at least, or order it, it's should be very interesting, I think, to do that. So last week, we came up to the point of someone dying. And then the question is, what do you do after that? So if you're someone who's around to take care of someone who's died, what do you do in a Buddhist tradition for someone who's died? And if you ask what is the Buddhist thing to do, there are so many different Buddhists that there's so many different possibilities of what you can do. And then even within Theravada Buddhism itself, there's various things that people do with the body afterwards. Sometimes the body is whisked off very quickly. And as quickly as they can, they bury the body or cremate the body. And sometimes the body is left in state for a long time. You leave it alone for a long time. And if it's some very important person in Thailand, they might leave the body in state for as much as a year. There's all kinds of reasons why they might leave the body kind of someplace without doing anything, without burying, without doing any final thing with the body. There's all kinds of things to do, and the Buddha didn't actually give any instructions for how to take care of... He gave instructions for how to take care of his dead body. But he very clearly used the model of a great emperor. Treat his body like a great emperor. At least that's what the records say. And so most of us are not great emperors. So it's not really appropriate, that kind of burial. So besides that, there's no instructions. And what's happened historically, I apologize if I said this last time, is that as Buddhism has gone through the different cultures of Asia, they have Buddhism has assimilated or adopted many of the local customs around death and dying as it seemed appropriate, as it seemed helpful. And did I say this last time? Did I explain this? Do you remember?
I think on Friday's retreat.
I said this. Okay. Sometimes I talk so much, it's hard to know what I said, where, when, and how. And I apologize. And so, you know, I adopted, you know, different practices that are useful from different cultures, in different cultures. So different cultures have different worldviews, different understandings of what a self is, and different understandings of what it means to be in relationship to other people. And so they have different rituals and practices because of who they are. And that means that for us also, we're unique. Western psyche is its own kind of psyche, or there's many psyches depending on the background we have, and families, ethnic, religious, whatever. And so different things, different rituals, different ways of doing it. If you're Irish, you know, it might be the best thing you could do is you get a massage table and put the body out there on the sidewalk and bring out the bear and have a party, which is what they do sometimes, I've been told. I don't know, I haven't seen that in Ireland myself, but I've been told that it's quite interesting. You know, it's very... And, you know, if you're other traditions, it's very sober and somber. Many different ways of doing it. And did I tell a story here last Wednesday about the Amazon rivers where I went? I mean, like I said, on Fridays, right? On Friday. So people are on Friday. You didn't hear last Wednesday? So this is an example of some of the customs, how different they can be. This is not a Buddhist one, but many years ago I had the opportunity to go sailing up one of the tributaries, or not tributary, I guess, but one of the side rivers, side shoots of the Amazon in French Guiana. And the kind of away from the Atlantic, the French Guiana is quite protected, the Native Americans, the Indians who live there. And the cultures are quite undisturbed for the most part. And we went to a place where mostly so-called, you know, certainly people from America, so-called civilized people, don't usually go. And there we found people called the Boni. And they're actually Africans who were enslaved and brought to South America, I think to Suriname by the Dutch. And then they escaped in the first generation. So the people who had been captured in Africa, they escaped from slavery. And so all their culture was intact in their heads. And they went into the jungles and stayed there for 200-300 years. And in some ways, they're more African than some of the people nowadays in Africa because they were so isolated, like an island. And we came into this little village where this woman had died, maybe that day. And we came just when they were building her coffin. And we could watch the big coffin being built around her body. And we were explained that evening there was going to be festivities, funeral festivities. So we stayed around. And when nightfall came, they were going to carry the coffin with this woman into this ceremonial hall, or I don't know, ceremonial dance hall, this hall, this kind of center of the village, that had no walls, just had thatched roof and posts holding it up. But there was an entryway. And there were six men carrying the coffin. And then they came to the entryway to this hall. There was a man blocking the way. And when they tried to enter with a coffin, he started pushing the coffin away and beating on it and yelling at it. As far as I could, the sound of the language was he was cursing at this coffin, banging it and pushing it away, refusing letting it in. This went on for a little while, and then suddenly he stopped, and then he took the place of one of the other coffin bearers, and the other coffin bearer came and took his place and did the same thing, prevented the coffin from entering the ceremonial place. And so finally, there was enough of that, and they let the coffin in. And then they had this party, music and dancing all through the night. And the coffin was just right there as part of it. And I asked, you know, what was that about? And the explanation was that the men carrying the coffin, some of the older men in the village, they'd known this woman all her life. She was an old woman when she died. And they had a score to settle with her. They had things to say, or, you know, things to... And before that she could be laid to rest, before they can kind of celebrate and have these festivities, you know, around her death, her life, they had to, you know, they had to get it off their chest and tell her, you know, what had to be said. So, you know, all these different customs and different cultures have different things which are useful. The Buddhist contribution to this is pointing to what is spiritually most helpful. And what's most helpful is that which helps people become released from any kind of holding in their hearts and their minds, their clinging. So what is it that's most helpful for that process is the Buddhist question. And in different cultures, there'll be different answers for that. So it shouldn't be under the assumption there's the proper, right Buddhist way to do it. There are very straight, you know, and true Buddhist things that you can do, and which is beautiful to do. And some of you might want to do it that way. But you don't have to feel like this is the way it has to be. You're actually quite welcome to design your own. Design your own funeral if you want. And then it's easier for the people who survive to know what to do. Or if one of your loved ones has died, you know, you don't have to, you can kind of, you know, find out, kind of figure out what's best for you. Sometimes it's very hard to figure out on your own, especially if you don't have any background in this kind of event. And then, you know, you can come to me or some other teacher or some other person who knows about these things and can help with the design or can decide themselves what's most useful. So after a person has died, and after you feel, you know, the person has died, as I said last week, there's some ambiguity in Buddhism, or ambiguity in life, and when death actually occurs. So the idea that it actually occurs with the final breath, maybe it's not so. And maybe a person continues for a while in some, you know, there are meditative states where a person stops breathing. And so, you know, is this end of breath a sign that consciousness has left, or that we don't know. So it's best to kind of sense or feel your way into this, the presence of the person, in case, you know, you have sensed the person still there beyond the final breath. You want to stay peaceful and calm in the room the best you can. If there's a lot of, if you feel like you're going to have to cry or grieve a lot, it's the suggestion in Buddhism is you actually quietly leave the room so you can keep the room peaceful and calm for the, to help that person who's dying or in the process of dying or dead. And but at some point you might feel, you know, the presence, the consciousness, the life force or something is gone. At that point, there are various views about, you know, it is a little bit hard for me to talk about because, you know, do I represent just myself or do I here to represent the Buddhist tradition? And if I represent the Buddhist tradition, then how do I hold the different views, you know? And I know so much. It's, one of the problems with people who study a lot is it's hard to, you know what's true. You know, if what you're learning is just from texts and teachers and stuff, because, you know, there's different teachers say different things and different texts say different things. And so if you want to be a fundamentalist, you don't want to go, you know, shopping around. You just, you know, stay with one thing. So it's a little bit hard, you know, so it's a little bit hard for me to know how to talk about all this. Now, one of the interesting aspects of that Buddhist theory of rebirth is that there's you can look at it from at least three different perspectives that all amount to probably doing basically the same thing. So the practices, how you actually, the practices and the ways you'd relate to death and someone who's dying would be the same, regardless in which way you hold the Buddhist teaching of rebirth. So the first way is that it's literally true. And most Buddhists believe that. It's very clear. The second is that it's really a metaphoric way of talking about life and death that happens moment by moment, which I talked about, I think, the first night. And the third way, which I didn't talk about, is that the whole idea, the whole description of rebirth in Buddhism is mythological language. It's a psychomythic language, meaning that it speaks to some deep aspects of our psyche that responds to ritual and to myths and to those kinds of stories. And it sometimes gets underneath the radar of our conscious, rational mind. And this, you know, something as profound as death, you know, affects the mind in deep, deep subconscious ways in our relationship to it. And so occasionally, or maybe not occasionally, many times, the rational approach is not going to get into what's really going on in the psyche. And sometimes the mythic descriptions, the mythic rituals, they might not be literally true, but they address that part of the mind which responds to myths. It informs it and changes it and heals it and things like that. So how do you treat someone after they've died? There's one belief that as long as the body is still around, the being who has departed in some form or other is still around you in the vicinity, somehow present, somehow is able to tune in. The person might not choose to tune in, but that capacity to tune in is still there. In which case, you would speak to it still and relate to it and as if, you know, they can hear you and say things that are helpful. Another view is that in Theravadin Buddhism is that once death has finally occurred, the final moment of death, that then that life force or the consciousness or whatever it is departs immediately and instantly is reborn someplace else. And so that body then, it's a body. It just, it's an inanimate object at this point. And you want to treat it respectfully in memory of the person. But there's no need to be particularly concerned about how you handle the body vis-a-vis what it's going to do for the person who's passed away and died. So there's these two different views. And what are you going to do about those two views, if you share any of those views? I think it's a really intuitive, a very personal thing. And so, but in both cases, whether you want, it comes to almost the same, what you would do. So one of the first things that happens is that you would, in a Buddhist tradition, you would do, so again, some of these readings. You would probably, minimum would be, you take refuge, go for refuge, with the idea that you're doing it for the person, with the idea that the person can hear it and then be inspired and helped. And you would do the precepts, which are so centrally important to healthy karma. And maybe you'd read some of the other things. And if it's not helpful for the person who's departed because they can't tune in, then it certainly is going to be helpful for those people who are left here, who are present. So it's a useful thing to do. Having a ritual, having some chanting to do, helps stabilize everybody in the room, helps create a sense of calm or concentration or presence or stability in the room. And it's very helpful. The Buddhist view is it's very helpful to maintain that peaceful, calm stability in a room after someone has died. And so chanting is one of those ways, reading is some of those ways to do that. So we can't always be sure who's getting the benefit, but it's a very beneficial thing to do. A very particular Buddhist thing that's done at various points, it can be done right after the body, the person has died, and it can be done later also as we go along, the ritual washing of the body. Now, practically, it's often very useful to wash the body, and sometimes hospice workers will do it for you, or nurses will do it for you, because sometimes there's all kinds of body fluids that get released with the death, and so it's nice to clean it up so that it doesn't smell too badly. But some people find it very helpful to do the washing of the body as kind of a ritual. It can be a very loving thing to do. So, it's the last time you're going to be with someone, you're going to kind of massage them, wash them. Maybe you wash them usually with yogi tea, or some kind of scented tea or something. Sometimes people put something in it, I don't know what it is, I don't remember right now what they put in, maybe some of you know. Something that helps close the pores. And so that helps slow down the decay process or the smelling process that might happen. But you wash the body, and there's various other things you might do practically, like putting cotton in some of the orifices so things don't continue coming out. And in some traditions, it's the women who do the washing. Nowadays, making those kinds of distinctions between men's work and women's work is sometimes not appreciated. But sometimes it might still be appropriate. And I'm not one to judge. If someone wants to say it's appropriate for the women to do it and not the men, in that circumstance, I'm not going to, go for it. But the ritual washing of the body and perhaps doing it with candles, flowers. Sometimes it's very nice after a person has died to ritually place flowers around the person, maybe on the chest, a flower in the chest, or some flowers around the head, have some flowers lit, and to create kind of a sacred environment for everyone who's going to be there. And people will come. And it's another time to say goodbye to a person when you're washing the body or after the person's died. You say another kind of farewell. Hopefully you've had a chance to do that before the person's died, kind of farewell. But it's often very nice to do it afterwards. It can also be very nice to do that as part of the memorial service. And address the actual person, have a photograph of the person, have the ashes there if you have the ashes, or have the body there if you have, and then it's more like a funeral, I guess, but actually address the person. Say goodbye or say what needs to be said.
So it can be actual washing or it can be a ritual washing. And the ritual washing in Theravadin Buddhism entails pouring water over the person's hand. So you'd have a bowl perhaps under the hand. You hold the hand over the side of the bed and you pour water over it. And part of what the tradition is as you're washing the hand, you're also asking the person for forgiveness. So, you know, so part of the saying goodbye is asking the person for forgiveness for any ways that you might have harmed them. And I suppose then also offering forgiveness for any ways they might have harmed you. There is a tradition of sitting and meditating with the body. And I've done that with bodies. At the Zen Center, they usually would keep bodies for 3 days. In Theravadan Buddhism, there is no particular idea of how long to keep the body. And it'd be very nice to get the really straight answer from me. This is the way you do it. This is the truth. This is the, you know. But I'm not capable of doing that because I don't know some of these answers, you know, in terms of this is the way it is. But there is a custom, and I find that very, for some people, it's very beneficial. It's very profound. And feels very helpful for all concerned to sit and just meditate with the body, have the body there. And sometimes people have will take turns, take shifts, so that someone's always there sitting with the body. And some people don't care for that so much. It's just enough, and they leave the body there, and maybe they'll go to sleep and leave the body alone at night, and then the next morning they'd be with the body a little bit. And some people like to sit near the body and just quietly reminisce about the person who's passed away. And I've seen that be quite a nice thing for people to do. But the particular Buddhist things is these very simple rituals, the washing of the hand, the chanting, the reading, and the meditating with the body. And sometimes the meditation is done. There's all kinds of meditations you can do, but I find it very helpful when I'm around a dead body. One thing, what I tend to do is two meditations. I do a loving kindness meditation, and I do choiceless awareness meditation. And choiceless awareness is a meditation. It's kind of like choiceless awareness is the awareness where you're not choosing any particular place to concentrate your mind, but you're open freely to be attentive to whatever comes to your door. Your sense doors, any sense doors. And to me, it seems very appropriate to do that after a person's passed away because I'm kind of like, you know, making myself an open receptacle? To receive whatever might be there still, the presence of the person, the communication, the sense, the intuitive sense of what's happening in the room, the sense of what's happening with the people who are still there. It seems appropriate to have this choiceless awareness. I'm kind of just tuning in. And sometimes I'll do this meditation without closing my eyes, because it seems very part of it then is keeping the eyes open. Because sometimes I'll just kind of be there and kind of just do this meditation where I'm kind of part of it is kind of just looking around the room, kind of taking it in. Because I have some feeling, I'm kind of just taking what's there with all my senses and trying to tune in the best I can. And from my own sense, with the idea that the more that I can be in a state of non-clinging, and at the same time as choices awareness is tuning in to what's there, that is helpful for the overall environment. That's helpful for, hopefully also for the person who's passed away, to somehow that there's a resonance that might be there. So if I get invited to someone's home, to one of your homes, because one of your people has died, and it seems like this is what's, it's appropriate to do, this is one of the things you can expect me to do, is I'll probably sit there for a while very quietly and just be with what's there. Yes, please.
You said you did a loving kindness meditation.
Yeah.
So can you kind of give a little flavor of what phrase you would use, and is it towards the departing person? Is it towards the people who are left behind or both?
Usually it's mostly to the person who's departed at that point. Usually the normal phrases. I mean, sometimes, may you be happy, may you be safe, may you be healthy. The person's, somewhere, in wherever you are. May you be at ease. And sometimes I might use kind of just spontaneous things that might arise. So then the question is... So there's various things that are done with the body. Keeping it for a while. Some people don't want that, don't feel comfortable with it, and and it's fine to get the mortuary service to come and get the body right away then in that case, or other, there's other services. I have a kind of a, I suppose it's a bias, to be honest, but a bias that, I have a bias that the Buddhist way is that all the stuff should happen as simply as possible. So not elaborate funerals, not elaborate memorial services, not elaborate caskets, not elaborate, you know, that it should be simple, kind of straightforward and kind of like, you know, Quaker style maybe. I imagine Quakers are simple and down to earth. And that's my bias. And there's no particular reason for that, and, you know, beyond my own view of the spiritual life. And certainly lots of Buddhists will have quite elaborate funerals. But I think the idea of doing simply, and so learning a little bit how to do that, learning you don't have to use a mortuary service at all, for example, and learning how you don't have to, you know, you can really get the cheapest possible casket. You can actually get a coffin. You can get cardboard. That's legal. They have cardboard coffins. They're the cheapest things you can get. There's a general assumption, a view that the Buddhist way of handling the body is to cremate it. And I think that's because it's very common in some Buddhist cultures to cremate a body. But it's there's no particular Buddhist way to do thing to do at this point. There are plenty of Buddhists around the world who bury their dead. There's plenty of Buddhists who, probably the majority, burn, I suppose. But there's also what's called sky burials, where you, I can say it in Tibet, I haven't heard of it anywhere else, but they leave the body up on the cliff tops to be eaten by the vultures. And the water burials, where you just throw the body into the water, and which I guess there's no water bodies here you can do that in, but in the Ganges you can do that. And if you go out in Varanasi on a boat, you have these bodies that float by. And so it's really up to you. You know, if the person said their wishes before they die, then, you know, honor those wishes. If they haven't said what their wishes are, then you have to kind of guess what their wishes are, guess what seems appropriate for you and your family or whatever. But kind of generally Buddhists tend to think of cremation. It tends to be cheaper overall, and it tends to be simpler, and it tends to, for the most part, be more ecological than the kind of funeral home, cemetery kind of approach, where they have lawns. And, yes? Yeah.
Some of the things that were required by state law, and I wondered what you knew about that. And the reason I'm asking is because you're saying, you know, the different types of, around the world, the different types of ways of dealing with the body. And I'm wondering, within the different types, what is allowed in our...
Legally.
Yeah.
It depends on the state, as far as I understand. Different states, all the different counties have different regulations around this. But in San Mateo County, there doesn't seem to be any limit, as far as I could tell. I'm talking to the people involved, of how long you can keep the body at home, short of, you know, becoming a health hazard. And sometimes I've been told that some of the neighbors sometimes will put pressure, because the neighbors get nervous about having, you know, a dead body more than a couple of days or a day or something. But you know, I think there's a lot of leeway. funeral homes and mortuary services are notorious for saying the things that would help business. Putting spin on things. And there are non-profit mortuary memorial associations that will help people know what their rights are, what's possible, and how to get the best deal and things like that. But it's very hard when everyone's kind of grieving. So, you know, they have you kind of in a vulnerable time. But you should be very careful when you talk to these mortuary services that you're really getting the straight story. You're only legally required to embalm a body if it's going to cross state lines. And in terms of leaving it for, you know, I never heard that 24-hour rule anywhere. Also, oh yes, you know, maybe. Sorry.
There is no such thing as a 24-hour rule in Central California.
Yeah. Yes, I never.
If you go to Neptune and you happen to die on Thursday or Friday, they don't ship out to where they're going to do their cremations until Tuesday or Wednesday.
So they have to keep.
About two or three times a week. They have to.
So you either keep the body at home or you have to send it to a mortuary service for a while.
Pardon?
So you either keep the body at home or you have to send it to a funeral home to hold it, or the morgue or something.
Again, those that go to Neptune, the pickup is usually from the home to Neptune directly, and very rarely is there a showing. There can be.
Right.
But that's up to the individual.
Right.
And then they may have a service or may not have a service after the fact, in terms of having the ashes given back to them. Again, there's a number of options there.
And so.
There are no timelines.
Right. That's my understanding. And so you know, if this happens, with a place to call, in San Mateo County, the people to call is the office or Department of Vital Statistics, and they're the ones who know all the regulations and what you can do, and they're the ones who can issue permits for the various things that you can get permission to do. In order to transport a body, you need to get a permit, but you can get a body and just, you know, put it in your back seat, in front seat, I guess, and, you know. carpooling. as long as you have a permit.
Just want to add a little bit of.
Yes, please.
And that is that you can't drive in the Diamond Line.
You cannot. because it's not a person anymore.
That's right.
And who's ruled that?
Pardon me?
Who's ruled that? Has it been ruled that way, or is it?
Yeah, I can tell you that you can.
So, yes?
When you had the cremation, could we back up a little bit? I know we touched briefly on prior sessions on organ donation and
life. Yes.
The body would have to disappear practically.
Yeah.
And I find myself personally quite torn between wanting to be a blessing by donating and wanting to give the family the sort of peaceful, quiet time. So what's it like when the body just gets whisked out, and how can you create a quiet space for them?
I don't have any experience with that, so I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. So there are some Asian Buddhists who have strong feelings about not having the body cut up, or not having certain ideas about how. Like Tibetan Buddhists to say, you shouldn't have the organs taken out prior to doing a certain transfer of consciousness ceremony they do. After that, you can do whatever you want because consciousness has been transferred. There are different views about it. The view that, you know, that that particular Theravadan view, that's a pretty instantaneous, and then it's, you know, it's off to the next life. You can just do it right for the body, so for the person's sake, you can then do the organ donation right away. My own kind of understanding or view about this, kind of my own logic of how this works, is that if there is kind of this process of death and rebirth, and the transfer intermediate time of consciousness before the rebirth happens. The person might be aware of the fact that that their body's being disturbed and cut up, but that it's such a wonderful thing. It's such a phenomenally beautiful, wholesome thing to do, to donate one's organs. It's so helpful that if that's what the person's wishes are, the benefits that come to oneself through the merit, are greater than the disadvantages of being disturbed. And so if that's what a person's wishes are, go ahead and do it. And then probably you need to follow the doctor's orders the best you can. And then tell the doctors that you would have a great value in trying to make a peaceful environment, quiet as you can. And what are the parameters that you're allowed to do? And I really don't know much about this. I have never had the experience with it. So you have to kind of feel your way. Yes?
Because I didn't grow up in this culture at all. I never had experience of anybody dying here. I don't know if it's true for everybody, but if anybody knows any information on, so if you or do organ donation, where would your body go? And do you have a choice of a particular location it can go? Secondly, some of the places you mentioned which will give you kind of a non-profit, you know, advice on quick cremations, or any institution that you said you want to talk to people concerned. If you can mention some of the resources, it would be really useful.
Yeah. What I'll do, I'm putting together a manual for a lot of this information. And then in that manual will be all kinds of, references to things. So you have to be a little bit patient. Hold off with your dying until you get the manual.
Yeah, I missed the last one, so
yeah.
You may have
it. No. And my mind's kind of blank. What was the first half of your question, the first thing you asked?
Like an organ donation.
Yeah. Oh, where it can go. So again, I don't know so much about this. It's a little bit hard to actually have the organ donation happen because you have to be in good condition. So, it's usually, I think it's kind of usually if your brain dead or you really don't have much chance to living, but you're at the hospital, that works best. If you die at home, it's probably, they're not going to get you to the hospital quickly enough. Other ways of donating your body besides organ donations. There's also donating your body for medical purposes or scientific purposes. And then you might end up, in the anatomy lab, or for studies by students. So the medical students can really learn and be trained. And that's quite a useful thing to do, too. And then probably that's probably a whole different scenario than how that's done. And I don't know if this is true, but I was told when I was growing up that a friend of the family's had a tattoo on the sole of her foot that said, property of UCLA. Because she was, so that's sounds really bizarre to me, but maybe that, my son believes that I grew up in the old days. So, back in the old days, things were different. Yeah.
Bruce's mom gave her body to be studied at Stanford. And all it was, you had to get a form filled out ahead of time that she had to sign, and then they just, you just call them.
Yes, sir. So certainly, the people who are going to survive you, it's really good if they know. If they don't know, then it's hard to have your wishes fulfilled. So okay, that's my take on this. Is that satisfying enough, my answer to you about?
Yeah, I understand. State of California a couple of years ago wrote a law in which they gave everybody a form on the back of their driver's license. Mm-hmm. But that is a hit or miss thing. It depends on where you are and whether you got your driver's license and whether you are not, and whether anybody bothers to deal
Look.
With your driver's license.
Right.
And the whole organ transplant donor thing is actually quite a bit considerably more disorganized than anybody believes. It's actually a matter of serious luck that anybody gets an organ, as near as I can tell. And it has been for a very long time, because I used to have a friend who worked at the Northern California Transplant Bank, and his take on it then, which was 15, 20 years ago, was the same then as it is now.
My sister got her kidney last spring, and it came from Boston. That's where they found a good match. She was on the kidney transplant list for, I think, 4 years. And she'd been told she'd be on it for 2 to 3 years, in the 4 years. And now I think it's probably 5 or 6 years on the waiting list. And there's a great need for it. And the whole issue of the organ transplant is a big, really important one. And Bruce, you had
I was just going to say the anatomy instructor, or whatever he was, I got to talk to him, so, you know, to find out what they were going to do. And he said they were going to do a new heart procedure, just to study a new heart procedure.
So, great.
But they also wanted to know, you know, what the condition of the body was. They wanted to know, you know, if the person died of an infectious disease,
sure.
If they had certain things. So they might be, I assume they might be picky.
Yeah, I can imagine. Oh, his mother, who was donated to Stanford, he asked what they were going to use it for, and he was told to do a trial kind of heart procedure, kind of learn how to do it, new procedure, and but that they're kind of picky about the bodies they will take because they're worried about infectious diseases and other things. So they'll ask you all kinds of questions. So it's kind of hit or miss whether they'll take you, even if you've offered. Yes.
On that same note, I don't know too much about organ transplants, but what I've heard is that there's a question. Many people question, you know, is the person really dead? Because they have to take the point that for some of the organs, the point at which they have to take
right.
the organ is so close to the time, and right. that's always concerned me. So, and I know you mentioned before saying, well, what is, you know, the question is, what is the point of death? I guess that's a question. I'm not sure where the question is in that,
yeah.
except to say that, you know, that concerns me.
Sure. Again, this is what I said earlier. My view on this, you know, there's no authority, you know, that ultimately can answer this, I think. But my view is that if it's the person's wish to have their organs donated, and it's such a powerfully beneficial thing to do, it's such a wholesome thing to do, that even if the person's still somewhat alive, to have their organs, what a great way to go. You know, it's such a wonderful thing to do. It hopefully makes the person really happy to know, oh, yes, I'm going now, but this is my last thing I'm going to do while I'm still alive. I'm donating my organs. Yeah. So my sense is not, you know, just, if that's the person's wishes, just go for it. And don't worry about this thing, well, the person's not really quite dead yet, or the Buddhists say it's, you know, not really dead for, you know, 3 days, I don't know, you know. Just, if the person's still alive, then they get more benefit from it. They get maybe be aware of that. What great thing they've done, and maybe they can die. The important thing in Buddhism is try to die with as good a state of mind as possible. And my hope is that if the person's heartfelt wish is to donate their organs, that's going to make their mind really good state. Wow, yes, I'm happy. What a great thing to have done. And whereas if you don't do it, and that's the person's wish, and they say, oh, they're going to go out. Those people, they didn't get around. You know, they might have a little bit of regret. So I think you just go for it and don't worry about, you know, these kinds of details. That's my take. So a couple of things, brief things about funerals and memorial services. Kind of repeating myself is, you know, you want to design in such a way that's helpful for everyone. But one of the customs that I know of in Buddhism is even if the memorial service is a week later or whatever, is it's very helpful to speak to the person. Not everyone has to. Maybe just the officiant, maybe one or two family members. But it's really, it's very powerful whether they actually communicate to the person or whether it's just for one's own psyche. It's very powerful to actually speak to the person and say what needs to be said. And, you know, even if it's not necessarily nice things, you know, because you're angry. Let me just, you know. Let me tell you about this, you know, I miss you, I'm sorry, I love you, but I got to tell you, when you did that to me, you know, I never told you how much it really hurt or whatever. And so speaking to a person is very powerful to do that. I think it's very helpful. And then to do some of these things, you know, do refuge, do precepts. If the whole audience, everyone there is kind of in the kind of Buddhist world enough, everyone can chant the precepts and refuges together and do some of these chants together. If most of the people there are not in that flow, in that tradition, then, you know, if I'm invited in, then I can do it. I'll just do it for the person. Dedication of merit. And there's various things that can happen in a funeral. Sometimes there's a little Dharma talk that's given. Of course, there's kind of usual things, kind of like a eulogy. I'm fond of having people, kind of Quaker style, people in the audience freely be able to stand and speak whatever they want to say, rather than have it all organized ahead of time where you know who's going to speak and it's all, but have some spontaneity to it and see who wants to speak, what needs to be said, and let it kind of have a life of its own, part of it. There's also some ritual things that I'm running out of time now, but a few ritual things that are done with thread and, again, with water and candles. And so just know that there are all kinds of ritual things that can be done and have symbolic value for a funeral memorial service. One of the things I wanted to talk about today, and we're running out of time now, is some of the ethical issues. For example, mostly euthanasia, but also suicide. Because this is a question that comes up around when someone's terminally ill and suffering a lot. What does Buddhists feel about the person committing suicide? Or euthanasia, will you somehow help the person? Euthanasia literally means good death. So help the person have a good death through passively kind of letting them, just not feeding them or not pulling them off life support, or more actively killing them. Mercy killing, it's called. It's a difficult topic to talk about again, because it reflects people's deepest understandings and views about what it means to be a human being and what happens after a person dies. And so for someone to come and impose even Buddhist ideas on that can be tricky, you know. So, because, you know, it's a very, very deep kind of area in persons and people's lives. However, probably the key Buddhist teaching that relates to all this question has to do with, is the basic Buddhist teaching having to do with the intentions that are the impulse, the cause, or the condition for which we do things. What's the quality of our intentions when we do something? If the intention is motivated by greed, hate, or delusion, then it's very clear in Theravada Buddhism, then it becomes an inappropriate action that should not be done. If it's motivated by the opposite, love, wisdom, generosity, then it's considered to be ethically beneficial, because the measurement is, you know, based on people's intentions. The problem with that is that are there circumstances where you might judge the greater good is going to come by following through on my unwholesome intention. So, for example, if you hate, the classic example is if you hate some great king who's going around murdering everybody, or some king is murdering everybody in their kingdom, and you have the chance to kill that king. And it's understood you can't kill someone like that unless there is some aversion in your heart. An aversion, if you kill someone, you create tremendously bad karma for yourself. It's morally unwholesome. But someone might evaluate and say, I'm willing to take on the bad that comes to me, the bad karma, the bad intention, all that. It comes from that because there's so much greater good that comes from saving all these people's lives. So there's those kinds of equations that go on. But those kinds of, that kind of logic is for the most part absent in Theravada Buddhism, for better or for worse. Mahayana Buddhism tends to have more of a gray area where you kind of more kind of getting a sense of what's the greatest good here. Whereas Theravada Buddhism tends to be much more black and white, that it's very clear that if the intention, if you have an intention of greed, hate, and delusion in your heart, then that's a morally unacceptable action to do. And the Theravada view is that in order to commit euthanasia, in order to actually do an act that causes a person to die, as opposed to passive approaches, letting the person, you know, nature take its course, that act, the claim is that in Theravada Buddhism, is that there has to be some aversion present for a person to push the button. Even though 99% of the motivation is out of compassion, when you really come down there, the argument is it's there's some aversion there, and therefore it's unacceptable. It's not an appropriate thing to do. Also, there's a tremendous amount of sanctity in life in Buddhism. And life is considered very precious, and the karmic unfolding and the spiritual process of any living being is considered very, very special, very precious, very sacred, and that to interrupt it by killing it or killing yourself is said to cause great harm and is morally inappropriate for Buddhists to do. So any kind of helping someone commit suicide is actually considered inappropriate also. Anything that helps someone else to die, anything that encourages someone else to die, because, you know, it's a really good idea if you die now, is inappropriate. Any kind of bringing it up, say, oh, by the way, have you thought about, you know, just, you know, not eating now and dying? Any kind of encouragement like that is considered unethical in the Theravada Buddhism. Right. But then the question is, what do you do if the person's wishes are, if I'm brain dead, I'd like to be, you know, all life support be taken away. If that's their wishes, then how do you negotiate between those two, the wishes and what your tradition says is ethical or unethical? Now, suicide in Buddhism is considered, for the most part, to be unethical. Because killing oneself is the same as killing someone else. Because self and other are not so different. It's like you're killing a human being. But also the logic that is probably behind most suicides is that things will get better. Or if they're not better, at least my suffering is going to stop. Because this is intolerable, the suffering I have now. And it'll end when I commit suicide. This puts an end to it. And with a view, Buddhist view of rebirth, there's no guarantee that's the case. And in fact, you're setting up the conditions for things to get worse, because it's such an unethical thing to, such bad karma to kill yourself. The chances are that you're making things a lot worse for yourself than it is now. So it's not the equation doesn't work in your favor, even though you might, you know, on the surface it might seem that way. If you don't believe in rebirth, then there's two other arguments against it along these kinds of lines. One is that the process of what happens in the last moments of death, you know, people sometimes recollect their whole lives in just like an instant when they're about to have a car accident or something. A whole lifetime can kind of be lived in a few moments of consciousness. And who knows what the karmic pain that you're going to have to go through if you commit suicide because of the karma of that in those last few moments. And you might think, well, 2 moments, you know, that's like nothing. I can live with that. But, you know, it's all this becomes quite relative in those last moments when time seems so hard. There's a whole different dimension to it. So you don't know what you're doing in suicide. And then and also a very important argument against it is what it does to the people who are left behind. And it causes tremendous distress and suffering for people left behind. And indirectly, their suffering is going to come back and haunt you, either in future lifetimes or in those closing moments. My belief, which I don't have any real basis to prove this, but my belief is that some of these things, that the dying process involves really a dramatic facing of your karma. And so rather than thinking you're becoming free of these things, again, the distress that you're causing other people will dawn on you at that moment, or somehow, and it could be quite difficult. So it's kind of, you know, bad news for those people who are thinking about suicide. But it's good news in some ways because it encourages people to find other ways to do it. Part of the argument in Buddhism is that as long as there's life, there's always the opportunity for spiritual purification and transformation. And that suffering is one of the vehicles for that to happen. And so you don't have to be so afraid of your suffering or try to avoid it at all costs. Yeah.
So where's the line between not intervening? Someone's dying and they could be kept alive on life support.
Right.
And by taking no action, how much action is that by choosing to let somebody
Yeah, good question. So let me... but there are a couple of circumstances where suicide is considered ethically okay or neutral or something. One is a very strange provision. It says that if you're engaged in your meditation, and you're really engaged and you're going for some deep realization experience in meditation, and you decide to forgo eating because you're so engaged, and then you die because you forgot to eat, you didn't eat, then it's okay. It's kind of like suicide because you're just going for it. You're just going for enlightenment. And then if you die because you didn't eat, then it's okay. Another is that if you have a terminal illness and you're going to die, you're about to die anyway, you're going to die soon enough anyway, and out of compassion for the people who are taking care of you, for the amount of difficulty and problems you're causing for them, it can be okay then to not to kill yourself, but to stop eating and let nature take its course. That's an argument that's made. And the last one is that if you have a terminal illness and you're going to die anyway, and you've already been enlightened, then it's okay just to stop. Because there's no more work to be done then, right? So in terms of needing to hang in there as long as you can to do whatever processing can be done, you don't need to anymore. So you just kind of let yourself go. So what about caring for someone else? And what about decisions around helping them die? My sense is that a Buddhist never wants to encourage it, never wants to be the first one to bring it up. But what if they bring it up? What do you do then? I think this is a very deep thing that each person is going to kind of figure out for themselves in the context of each situation. But my understanding of what I've read, what I understand from teachers and stuff in the Theravada tradition, doing anything that kills a person is ethically unacceptable. Doing something that where the person simply allows the person to pass, to nature take its course, so removing life support, for example, moving life support lets nature take its course, is acceptable if the intention is one of compassion. If it's simply like, this is, I've been dealing with this person now for 7 years, and I can't take it anymore, and let's just pull the plug. That is not acceptable. So you have to also have a sense that this is the wishes of the person. They have to convey it in some way. And it's very difficult to use. You have to be very careful in using the justification of compassion as a reason why you're going to help someone to die peacefully, so-called peacefully. And that is that the three sources of bad karma are greed, hate, and delusion. And there can be delusion infused with compassion. So you have to be very careful that there's no delusion going on at this time also. So the tendency in Theravada and Buddhism is to be very careful about the moral quality, the ethical quality of these kinds of acts, and to be very, very careful so not to create this very atrociously bad karma of somehow being responsible for someone else's death. Yeah.
One of the things that is not a
Oh yeah, that's beautiful, because that's what they have to do. That's what's happening anyway.
Yeah.
And so that's part of, if I go to sit with someone who's dying, at some point I'll be doing letting go meditations with them, encouraging them, and also this thing of giving permission to go. But that's not wishing them to die. It's just like there's this process going on, and you can feel them holding on, and they're suffering because they're holding on. And so you're not really encouraging them to maybe die. You're encouraging them to not suffer and to let this process happen. Smita.
I can imagine at a time of a loved one is on life support system, would be very hard. I mean, I'm just thinking of myself, it would be a very hard time for me to sit and come to understanding what my real intentions are. And if it is delusional, I mean, it's hard enough sitting on this chair right now. I don't know what my intentions are, but at that time would be very hard. If the person has given permission, within my household many of us have, about not continuing on life support system, then should I, do I still have to go over that step of seeing what my intentions are, or if that person has given permission and has written very specifically, then as the nearest one, so far the hospital is concerned, am I allowed to give permission without really coming to terms with that?
You have to be always careful with your intention. And sometimes intentions are mixed, and sometimes they're kind of vague what our intentions are, but you want to be very careful as you can. And then kind of find your way. So your intention is not mixed with, you know, greed, hate, and delusion.
So never mind what the person said.
Well, if you're responsible, if you're going to be responsible for that person dying.
Yeah, the person said very clearly, wrote down, you know, do not continue on life support. Do I still give them the permission to pull the plug, even though part of me is going to find it convenient,
mm-hmm.
and part of me is going to be sad, and I'm sure there's nobody in my life that I, for whom I would have that way, for whom I would not be sad. But
what do we do when our intentions are mixed, which sometimes they can be, mm-hmm. you know, 90% one way and, you know, 90% pure and 10% impure. And what do we do then? You know, these are very difficult questions. I'm very uncomfortable, you know, saying anything almost about these things. And when I say things like the traditional Buddhist view is this, I'm being very careful to say, you know, that I'm not trying to say this is what the truth is, because, you know, I don't really know some of these things. But they're very difficult issues. But the main thing that we're trying to look at, Buddhism is suggesting, is look at the quality of the intention. And look at the sacredness of life, and Buddhism teaches that people have their own karma to work through, and you don't want to interrupt that karma. And also they have their own spiritual process that they're going through. And as long as a person is a human being, and so some kind of consciousness is still going on, there's a possibility that they can work through. And there are lots of experiences of people in comas who seemingly, you know, are unconscious, but you come up next to them and you speak to them, and they seem to hear and register at some level. So some processing going on there. And who are you to know? You know, who are you to know what is really going on for that person? So the tendency in Buddhism is to be very respectful of that person's own karma and abilities. And, you know, it's considered extremely rare to be a human being. And the opportunity in human form is so great that you don't want to interrupt that, and just, you know, try to preserve it as much as you can. But then the question is, you know, what about when it's a person suffering a lot? You know, sometimes medical interventions means a person will suffer more. One of the interesting questions is, so Buddhism puts a tremendous value on having a positive, wholesome state of mind as you're dying. So is it better to die in a wholesome state of mind earlier, or to die, you know, with, you know, morphine-induced, you know, stupor, or, you know, nausea, or, you know, some medical interventions will keep you going, but the quality of your life is going to deteriorate. And is it maybe better just to, you know, not to have the medical interventions and just let yourself die in a kind of, where your mind is still clear and kind of be present for it in a way. So a lot of it depends on the kind of medication, what the effect it's going to have on you, and, you know, the balance of how much suffering things are going to cause or not cause. And I find these questions very hard. And maybe if I had a lot more experience with them, I had very, very, almost no experience with these kinds of directly. So I don't really have the experience to give to talk as if someone who's actually grappled with these things myself. I'm aware of these things. I've talked to people about it indirectly and read about them and things like that. But I find it very difficult. And I wish I could be more cogent about it. And I was thinking about this week, talking about this, I was very acutely aware of how this really, the delicacy of talking about this, because it really points to really core views that people have about what it is to be a human being, what religious life is all about, what life and death is all about, and this very deep area that people's lives. And then how do we talk about that with authority?
We've concentrated on all the people dying, but at work, one of my coworkers just had her baby die after 3 days.
After 3 days?
Areas,
in the local paper, there was I looked at the police blotter last week, and it said that the fire department or something came to some house, someplace, to because there was a report that a 6-day-old baby had stopped breathing. So there's various various things. I mean, there's a Buddhist idea which some Buddhists find a lot of solace in, is that it's the working of karma. And so, it's the karma, the fact that someone dies after a few days as a child. That's the karma of that person to have that kind of life. But that's a little bit simplistic, because the Buddha himself said that the karma is not the only reason why someone might die. There are non-karmic causes to people dying. Illness, for example, it doesn't seem to have a karmic source. I don't know what to say.
You say the Buddha said illness doesn't have a karmic source?
Doesn't have to. There are non-karmic sources there are non-karmic sources of illness and death.
Is there a way to determine?
Well, I left that manual at home.
They can be very confusing. I mean, if you're a doctor, are you supposed to help and heal people or let them live and die through their karma? I mean, it's confusing.
Uh-huh. Well, it's their karma to get born in a circumstance where they have access to doctors. So, doctors do what they can. I think that... healing is never, as far as I know, I've never seen anybody suggest that the doctrine of karma implies you should not help someone heal.
And with all kinds of acts of helping, too.
Right.
Normally one would think that it is good to help to the extent you can. But then should you stay away from helping somebody because you're interfering with their karma, they will be reborn and have to live through the whole experience.
The thing about interfering with someone's karma is that I know about is this thing about death. To help someone die prematurely is to interrupt the working of their karma in this lifetime. That's the specific teaching on that. Other circumstances, we're supposed to be as helpful as we can to each other. I'll stay and answer a few more questions, but people are beginning to go. It's late. But I wanted to end with this point. So this topic of death and dying has a lot to do with, for a lot of people, with notions of karma or what happens after we die and all this. My personal view is that I don't know what's the truth or talked about some of these things. But what I do have a tremendous amount of confidence in, so much so I feel like it's enough. You don't need to know anything else. And that is the tremendous power of being fully present for what's happening right now. And that fully present means present in such a way that you're finding your way, or you work your way, you practice your way to being fully present without any greed, hate, and delusion. So the practice of presence is what is significant, is phenomenally significant in all these circumstances. To bring our presence to someone who's dying, to bring presence to our death, to bring a sense of presence to what's happened, you know, the period after someone has died. That these kinds of questions, that what happens and after death, and a lot of these questions are secondary to the importance of really bringing presence to what's happening there. I know that doesn't answer some of the questions around euthanasia, and I think that euthanasia is such a difficult one that each person's going to really have to search their own hearts to find out what seems most appropriate. And each situation is probably different from every other one, so it's also situational. But I hope that your Dharma practice, your mindfulness practice, is teaching you the skills and the value, the faith, in the importance of being present. Being present now, being present now, and then doing again for the next now, and then for the next now. And someday, the next now will be your last breath. It's just another now. And then what happens after that? It's just another now. So cultivate your presence and share your presence with the people that you love. So those are my thoughts, and I'll stay if you have more questions. And I hope this three-day class has been useful, and it certainly stimulated me a lot in terms of thinking about a lot of these things, about how it might be useful for our Sangha. And I have a lot more to pass on, and I think that it'll have to take the form of this manual that I'm putting together. And someday I'll let you know. If you don't come to our Sangha on any kind of regular basis or at all, except for this, if you want to know about this manual, you can contact us in 6 months or so and see if it's been done by then. Okay, thank you.